Greetings and welcome to this KGVM program on the responsibility of land-grant universities in the Anthropocene. I'm Yvonne Rudman, a KGVM board member. Normally, I'm in the background serving as KGVM's secretary and grant writer, but recently I heard an MSU Institute on Ecosystems program that had a lot of interesting information on campus climate initiatives that I thought the KGVM audience would find informative and thought-provoking. With me today are Dr. Paula Chappelle and Dr. Patrick Belmont, the presenters of the IOE program I heard. Welcome to both of you, and I'd like to introduce you to our audience now. Dr. Paula Chappelle is a professor in the Department of Political Science at Montana State University, Bozeman. Dr. LaChapelle's research spans many disciplines, including community, climate change resiliency, diversity and inclusion, and social justice topics. He serves as the faculty advisor to a student group, the Campus Climate Coalition, and also to an outreach organization called Climate Smart Montana. I've known Paul for several years and I'm always impressed with how he makes his research relevant and accessible to the community. One of his latest publications, titled Addressing Climate Change at the Community Level, shows his commitment to working with communities. Paul, hi, and thank you for being here today.
Great to be with you.
Also with us today is Dr. Patrick Belmont. Dr. Belmont's a professor and the head of Department of Watershed Sciences at Utah State University. He conducts research in the fields of hydrology, geomorphology, and climate science. Currently, he's studying wildfire impacts on fish populations and water reservoirs. He recently completed studies on how climate change impacts ski resorts and the management of public lands in the U.S. West. Dr. Patrick Belmont co-presented with Dr. LaChapelle at MSU's Institute on Ecosystem program last month. Welcome back to Montana, Dr. Belmont, via our virtual connection.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for covering this.
It's great to have you here. Since we'll be talking about the responsibility of land-grant universities in the Anthropocene, let's start off by defining a few terms. Paul, could you please give us some background on land-grant universities and how they've become relevant to the issue of climate change?
Sure. Land-grant universities are the result of a law that passed a long time ago, back in 1862. It was called the Morrill Act, and it was intended to provide a broad segment of the population with what was called practical education, and that was education that would have direct relevance to their daily lives. So this was part of a process of, and the intent of democratizing education and democratizing access to information, so that education would no longer be kind of a exclusive to those who are wealthy or rich, part of the bourgeoisie who could afford to go to private school or to an Ivy League school. This allowed an opportunity for many people who couldn't afford a private institution. And these land-grant universities are not just about campus learning, but they're explicitly about outreach to citizens. And this is really what land-grant universities are compelled to do. So the Morrill Acts of 1862 and then a subsequent act in 1890, and then again in 1994, an act called the Equity in Educational Land-Grant Status Act has established these institutional categories of land-grant, what we now refer to as our land-grant system. So the 1862 institutions are the first land-grant universities. The 1890 institutions are what are referred to as historically black colleges and universities. And then the 1994 institutions are tribal colleges and universities. And today there are 112 of these land-grant institutions across the United States and territories, of which 19 are historically black and 33 are tribal. And I'll note that 7 of those tribal colleges are occur here in Montana. Now, just a little more background, and I guess the relevancy to our topic today, and I want to reference the APLU. This is the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities. This is an organization of leading research universities and universities within this public and land-grant system in Canada and Mexico and the United States. And they produced a foundational statement titled The Knowledge Zone of Ideas, Progress, and Free People. Again, we're hearing this democratizing tone to this piece. So according to the APLU, land-grant universities all have the public purpose of educating students, undertaking research, and contributing solutions to the problems facing their regions, countries, and the international community at large. The document goes on to say that land-grant universities are uniquely positioned to address the challenges and opportunities facing the continent. As public institutions, they must contribute to the solutions and progress of the region through education, joint research, and collaborative problem solving, unquote. And it's interesting to note, you know, when the Morrill Act was passed in 1862, of course, we were just entering this horrible period of our American history, the American Civil War. And Abe Lincoln made a statement about the passing of this act. And he said, quote, "The land-grant university system is being built on behalf of the people who have invested in these public universities, their hopes, their support, and their confidence," unquote. I think that confidence by the people really is the foundational piece of these land-grant universities. These are institutions that are made up of faculty, of students, and researchers, and staff, and administrators. And it's incumbent on all of us to uphold this fiduciary, to uphold this public trust. It's an obligation. I would argue it's a legal obligation and perhaps even a sacred obligation to inform and educate on the risks and threats to the public's health, welfare, and safety. And I think this includes specifically an obligation to alert the public of the current climate crisis that is unfolding. But most importantly, to do it in a way that is very public and very overt. And I think to consciously not uphold that fiduciary is a political act. It really is the prime directive of these universities is to educate. And, you know, I think they're by upholding this fiduciary, we in turn uphold this confidence that Lincoln spoke about. So, you know, again, this moves us to kind of our topic for today, the responsibility of land grants in the Anthropocene. And the evidence is clear. The climate change presents a clear and present risk to our health, welfare, and safety. And we're seeing that playing out in just the last several weeks, specifically with the COP21, the Conference of Parties, COP26, the Conference of Parties, and the statements that have been made around that. UN Secretary General Guterres has said that the latest IPCC report, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, he says of the report, the alarm bells are deafening. The evidence is irrefutable. According to the report, the evidence is unequivocal. The short answer to this is that the Earth is warming. Humans are primarily responsible, and the outcome is potentially grave or catastrophic. So the warnings are clear, and we've heard them over and over. Patrick and I quoted some of these in the presentation we gave that you referenced, I think most notably by the British historian, natural historian and author Sir David Attenborough, when he says, quote, "The Holocene has ended. The Garden of Eden is no more. We have changed the world so much that scientists are saying we are in a new geological age. The Anthropocene, the age of humans. Right now, we are facing a man-made disaster of global scale, our greatest threat in thousands of years, climate change. If we don't take action, the collapse of our civilization and the extinction of much of the natural world is on the horizon," unquote. I don't think we could have a more stark and clear warning than that. So the climate crisis is upon us. We recognize this as academics. We recognize many in the public recognize this. And we have very few years left to mitigate what many assert as the potential for unprecedented disruption threatening the prospects for organized human life. So I think this clearly rises to the challenge of what a land-grant university should do, and that it should be proclaimed from every lecture hall and from every administrative meeting and memo, and sadly, it's not. And I think that's reflected in data from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication that still, unfortunately, with data here in Montana, of course, they offer data across the United States, the data in Montana suggest a wide disparity in public opinion and knowledge about climate change. So, for example, In many parts of Montana, upwards of 45% of the population believe that most scientists still disagree that global warming is even happening. And of course, the reality is that the scientific consensus is over 99%. And again, another statistic, data from the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. Most counties of Montana, 60 to 70% of the population rarely or never discuss global warming. So I think clearly land-grant universities have an obligation and indeed a mandate to address this misinformation or lack of information, particularly when the stakes are so high, as I said, with risks to our health, welfare, and safety.
Well, Paul, that's a lot of sobering information that I hope we get a chance to hit many of those points that you've pointed out. I'd also like to point out that in the tribal colleges, when they were designated as land-grant institutions in 1994, we have 7 tribal colleges that you mentioned here in Montana. So Montana now has the greatest number of land-grant universities in the country. So we've got a lot of faculty, students, administrators, staff on the ground. Tribal colleges are working at various stages to assess climate adaptation priorities on their reservations also. So Patrick, getting back to explaining the title of the program, could you please define Anthropocene and its relation to climate change?
Sure. So the Anthropocene is a geological time period in which humans are exerting a dominant influence on Earth processes at a global scale. You know, geologists have names for all these different time periods throughout Earth history, and they can look at the rocks and tell us what was happening at these different times throughout the history of the Earth. They can tell us about what kinds of organisms were living then from the fossils that were left behind. They can tell us all kinds of things about the climate from the chemistry of the rocks. So geologists, you know, have divvied up Earth's history into all these different time periods. And the fact of the matter is that at this point, humans are moving more dirt than nature. You know, we have more trucks digging up dirt and moving it around than all of natural processes combined, all the landslides and erosion that's happening and things like that, all the sediment that's moving in rivers. We're far exceeding the amount of dirt moving around the landscape. Humans have been distributing plastics to the most remote parts of the world. There are plastics all over the place at this point. We're responsible for the extinction of a lot of species, and that's going to show up in the rock record that's being created during this time for the future. And we are fundamentally altering the chemistry of the atmosphere in a lot of different ways. But certainly one of the most relevant ones is by putting a lot of greenhouse gases up into the atmosphere. So humans have profoundly disrupted a lot of natural cycles, and we've altered Earth processes to the extent that we've been altering what rocks will look like that are being formed at this time period. So if you can imagine, you're a geologist thousands of years from now, when you look back at the rock record that was formed during this time period, you'd look at it and say, there's something very strange going on here. It's a different set of processes. So, you know, we've developed all these incredible technologies and capabilities to travel and make stuff, and that's all great in one way, but we are currently doing it in a way that undermines many of life's Earth support systems. We're doing it in a way that undermines many of Earth's life support systems. We have to figure out a way to exist on this planet while not undermining those support systems.
So I listened to your TED Talk last night, and you mentioned how important it was when you had a collaborator told you about the importance of meshing human and natural systems and evaluating them together.
Yeah, so I, you know, had gone through a lot of my undergraduate and graduate career just thinking about natural systems. And I was thinking about various aspects of ecology and geology. But, you know, at this point in history, we can't decouple the natural world from the human influenced world. I mean, we are really influencing the world in just about every way possible, in even the most remote parts of the world. So in some sense, there isn't anything that remains that's natural in a pristine sense. And so to some extent, it kind of calls on us to redefine what we're calling natural. But the more important thing is that we always have to be thinking about these things, about what the natural processes are going on, how humans are interacting with those natural processes, and what the implications are, not only for the processes themselves, but our economy is wholly dependent on all of these natural processes that occur. The Earth produces a lot of free goods and services for us, and we have to figure out ways to interact with nature in ways that don't undermine that.
I was also struck by your comment about that this climate change is not a natural cycle, and how you compared that to geologic time.
You're right, indeed. You know, this has been a discussion point for a long time. We've known about global warming since 1856. An American scientist, Eunice Foote, published the first paper saying, if we put a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it could change the chemistry and the heat trapping capacity of the Earth. So she told us that, you know, over 170 years ago. Shoot, I just lost track of your question.
That's okay. I was just struck by the cycles, how quick we've changed the climate in comparison to how long it took to change the climate in the past.
Right. So Eunice Foote told us that we could be changing the chemistry that long ago. But there was a legitimate scientific debate for a long time about how much of the changes we're seeing are just natural. And there was actually a lot of concern for decades about whether or not we were actually heading towards another ice age, and whether putting all this carbon in the atmosphere might be a good thing to hedge against an ice age. But really, you know, by the 1950s, that debate was over. We knew that we were not heading into another catastrophic ice age. We've known since the 1950s with high confidence that continuing to put carbon pollution in the air is going to take us outside of natural conditions and potentially be very problematic. And yet, ever since the 1950s, we've continued to put more and more carbon pollution in the air at an increasing rate.
Maybe I'll add too, Patrick, it's interesting to hear you say that. And one of the things that I introduce in my classes is a statement that basically says, you know, based on this cutting edge research, the knowledge that increased CO2 based on many, many decades of our understanding, is that we have the potential to drastically alter the chemistry of the ocean and the atmosphere, producing the potential for catastrophic warming. Now, I ask my students, who might have come up with a statement like that? And of course, hands go up. Was it Al Gore? Is it Nancy Pelosi? Et cetera, et cetera. Well, the next slide I show is this was a statement produced by ExxonMobil. Exxon at the time, of course, was involved in the 1970s in some of the most cutting edge research in atmospheric chemistry, because they understood that this could affect their bottom line. And so this was, I believe, the research scientist was James Black who produced that. And it's, of course, all of these documents now are out for public consumption. But the point is that our government has known for many, many decades. The private sector has known for many decades. And, of course, the scientific academies have known as well that the potential for a catastrophic outcome is great. And, of course, that evidence continues to mount through the 1990s, the early 2000s. So this is not a new phenomenon or understanding or set of data that we have. As Patrick, I think, rightly recognizes, we've known this for many, many decades.
I just want to note that a lot's happened since both of you presented at MSU's Institute last month. News about climate change is happening at every level of society. Locally, MSU just released a news article about its award-winning energy districts, just one of which has resulted in a $1.7 million energy savings over the past 15 years. MSU's energy administrators stated that MSU is making energy use improvements for multiple reasons. They said it's the right thing to do, and that as a land grant, MSU is a steward of taxpayer dollars and student tuition, and that these improvements make clear financial sense. And they're also responding to student awareness. They said students are increasingly more conscious about their energy and use and what impact that has. Then on the national scene, Congress is wrangling with whether and how to include climate mediation in the current economic package that's being debated. And finally, internationally, the UN Conference on Climate Change, COP26, that Paul mentioned, is meeting as we speak in Glasgow, Scotland. 6 years ago, while the UN Climate Change was meeting in Paris, Dr. Jack Payne, the former chair of the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, which Paul also referenced, and as the VP of Agriculture at the University of Florida said, land-grant universities must lead on climate science. He said land-grants must help break the gridlock. On whose science are we to believe? Paul and Patrick, given this international, national, and local context, can you please bring us up to date what's been happening on the MSU and Utah State University campuses? And would you like to start by giving an update on the six-point strategy in your previous presentation?
Sure. Happy to start. This is Paul. And, you know, I'm sure many of us recognize there are, you know, many strategies that land-grant universities can focus on to address the current climate crisis. We tended to just try to boil these down to six as a way to just start to outline what a useful strategy moving forward, what it might look like, and what might be, you know, a truer reflection of our land grant obligation. So the first thing that we can do as land grant institutions is that we can declare a climate emergency. And this would be, we do this in a very deliberate and a very public way. And again, I think this speaks to our obligation of climate education to students and to citizens. I'll note that to date, more than 7,000 colleges, universities, technical schools, and community colleges from around the world have already declared a climate emergency. And I've heard that number is upwards of 10,000 universities now. And we can just think of an emergency as, you know, just any situation that requires immediate action to prevent a potential catastrophic outcome. And I don't think anyone who studies this topic would argue that the climate crisis, you know, doesn't rise to this level of an emergency. So I think declaring a climate emergency really, it changes the whole nature of the urgency of the situation in higher education. But what specifically does this action do? To me, it's more than just a benign statement. It sends a very clear and public message to students and to the rest of our campus community and to citizens across the state and beyond that a land-grant university understands the severity of the problem and it takes seriously the necessary steps to address that through education and through its own policies. So at MSU, I'm currently working with colleagues in a faculty senate. We now have 48 co-sponsors on a faculty senate resolution, and this resolution has three parts. The first is to declare a climate emergency for the points that I just stated. And secondly, it stresses the advantages of joining what's called the President's Climate Leadership Commitment. And this is the longest standing voluntary carbon reduction program in the world. And through this commitment, universities then have access to a network of over 600 other universities and colleges. And of course, there's many benefits to joining this commitment, access to resources, professional guidance, in-kind services, et cetera. And so signing this commitment and joining the Climate Leadership Network makes a very public declaration that the university intends to address the climate crisis and it provides a framework and a reporting structure to support accountability and track progress towards that goal of that important goal of carbon neutrality. And then the third thing that our MSU Faculty Senate resolution will do, and again, I want to stress that this is still being discussed and debated, and likely will change because there's not unanimous support for this resolution. The third thing that this resolution would do is it would advocate for a dedicated fundraising campaign that would function as a way to supplement legislative funding, so that we wouldn't be beholden to, you know, the various political winds that seem to blow here in Montana. So it would create a green fund that would serve to provide additional funds for climate action planning and implementation. And again, my hope with all of this work is that any kind of a capital campaign would be very open and transparent and public in terms of the marketing and collecting and administering those funds. Again, the key word here is that it's public. We're a public institution, and we do these things publicly. I also want to note that our student Senate body, the ASMSU, the Associated Students of Montana State University, recently passed a resolution declaring a crisis and urging resources, university resources, to addressing the climate crisis. And in their words, a rapid, sustained, and immediate response. And those are words from the IPCC report that I referenced. I know Patrick has worked with his colleagues at Utah State University on a faculty Senate resolution, and really interesting how he worked with his colleagues to pass overwhelmingly a faculty Senate resolution that frankly has much more detail and commitment than the one that's currently being debated at MSU. Patrick, I'm curious if you want to offer anything about that process.
Sure. Well, that kind of started back in October of 2018, when the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, put out a special report talking about what kind of damages we incur on a global scale if we get up to 1.5 degrees warming, and how much worse it gets if we get up to 2 degrees warming. And one of the things that they did in that report was to put more of the emphasis on individuals and institutions actually making change. Up to that point, you know, we've really relied on governments to try to figure this out. And it was just pretty clear at that point that, well, governments are not getting it done. We need individuals and institutions to take more of a leadership role in this. So a number of faculty and I got together and started saying, well, what more can we do as faculty at a land-grant institution to make real progress on this problem? And the first thing we started to do is to look at, you know, the amount of pollution, carbon pollution, that our own institution has been creating. And it's great that we've been keeping really good records of that. But when we looked at that data, what we saw was, you know, in 2007, we had committed to go carbon neutral by 2050. And between 2007 and 2018, we had made zero progress towards that goal. Zero. It was about 100,000 tons of carbon pollution that we were creating every year. And, you know, we said, you know, as a faculty, we need to make sure that people understand this is not okay. Maintaining a consistent level of pollution is not enough. So we wrote this Faculty Senate resolution that basically established the goal of a 10% reduction in carbon pollution each year for the next 20 years. That's consistent with what the science is telling us we need to do to remain below 1.5 degrees warming, which is a pretty important threshold in climate change. And, you know, there was certainly a bit of turbulence as we were bringing that through the Faculty Senate, but in the end, it passed 56-1 in our Faculty Senate. It was very strongly worded. It started to outline a plan, and it was overwhelmingly supported in the Faculty Senate, that we really do need to start doing better by our students in terms of reducing our own carbon pollution. The president accepted that statement and kind of turned it back to us and said, okay, help us figure out how to do this now. And so myself and the sustainability director and the dean of the College of Natural Resources and a number of other faculty across the campus, the university, got together and started developing a set of recommendations. And these recommendations span how we might change our construction on campus, how we might change any of our activities, how we might incentivize low carbon transportation, and how we might start to integrate climate change more into our educational and extension programs. And so we built a very comprehensive plan, I would say, over 6 or 8 months. We ended up sending that out to the entire community. It was, you know, over 30,000 people got to review that document. We got 1,700 comments on it with questions, suggestions about different things we could do. We responded to all those, revised the plan, and presented that. And in the end, the president endorsed that greenhouse gas reduction plan. I can talk a bit about the nuts and bolts of that plan if you want. I do want to come back to talking about some of the points you made, Yvonne, about marketing things that we're doing well. Mm-hmm. So one of the concerns that I have, we should be celebrating our successes. This is a difficult path. And there are lots of different things that need to happen in order to reduce our carbon pollution. But I really want to caution against overhyping the successes that we have. You know, they really need to be put into context. Because if we're taking credit for every little thing that we're doing, it's just kind of constant barrage of look at how great we're doing, patting ourselves on the back, when in the end, we may or may not be meeting the goals that we really need to meet.
I think that's a good point as far as critical thinking and teaching the students how to evaluate what they read about general news or about their institution or legislation that's being passed in every realm of government and private endeavors.
Right. It's easy to market these things and to say, you know, we're doing a great job, pat ourselves on the back. But in the end, we need to really evaluate all these gains in the context of what needs to be happening. You know, this is a problem of physics, first and foremost. And yeah, physics is very unyielding. And so ultimately, we need to get our emissions, our carbon pollution down to zero. A term that is often used for this is greenwashing. You know, where we're constantly saying, you know, what a great job we're doing, how sustainable we're being. But in the end, we may or may not be getting the nuts and bolts down. So, you know, I think we do need to celebrate our successes. At the same time, I think we need to make sure that we keep our eyes on the only goal that really matters. And that's getting fossil fuel carbon pollution down to zero. And until that time, we still have not done right by our students.
Good point.
Patrick, you mentioned climate action planning, and this is kind of the second strategy that we had suggested moving forward on, that that land-grant universities really need to lead by example. And, you know, in addition to signing on to the president's climate leadership commitment, they've got to reduce greenhouse gas emissions drastically. And as you mentioned, you know, this is not a little bit each year over the course of the next 30 years. If we take our commitment seriously as a developed country, and again, as an institution of higher education, that we're shooting for that 10% annual emissions reduction target, 15%, you know, that is what the IPCC, what the best available science is telling us that we have to do. And again, I'll just go back to saying that we need to do this in a very deliberate and a very, very public way. So again, you know, by doing this, again, signing on to the president's climate leadership commitment, it sends that message that the land-grant university takes this situation seriously, and intends to act deliberately, that they can agree to identifying climate neutrality dates, but more importantly, that they've got those very those immediate, rapid, and sustained emissions reductions plans in place, and that they're reporting on this annually in a very public way on a public site. Now, I've done just a quick inventory of land-grant universities, and out of the 112, only 25 of them have signed on to this president's climate leadership commitment. So not a great track record there. I'd like to talk a little bit about what's happened at Montana State University. We have had a climate action plan in place. It was drafted in 2010. and posted on our website, and it mandated that we update that plan every 2 years. We have not updated that plan since 2010. Then in 2019, Montana State University went through its own strategic plan process that was at a campus-wide level. That was called the Choosing Promise Strategic Plan. And in that plan is the following text. It says that, quote, Montana State University will develop a comprehensive sustainability plan by 2020 with measurement and annual progress reports to campus, unquote. So many of us working in what was used to be called the Campus Sustainability Advisory Council, or CSAC, we worked for over a year to produce a very detailed plan that, again, was mandated in this overall MSU strategic plan. This was approved by the council, the CSAC council, in June of 2020. And then the council received an email that MSU administration preferred that we delay the release of the plan because of the upcoming legislative session. So we put our heads down, and many of us were disappointed. But we again submitted this plan 14 months later in just August of this year in 2021. And we were told, and this is reflected in the minutes for the Sustainability Council, that there should be, quote, less public-facing detail, unquote, to the plan, and that we should develop a framework instead of a plan. So again, this is counter to the Choosing Promise strategic plan, the university plan, that says that we will develop a comprehensive sustainability plan by 2020. Now, the recommendation from MSU administration was also to terminate the Campus Sustainability Advisory Council, and that has been in operation for 13 years. And it was an incredibly unique and progressive body. It was made up of students and staff and faculty and even members of our community that had a direct report to the president. And the mandate of the Sustainability Council was to advise the university president about sustainability efforts. And so many of us really are just disappointed with this history. But looking forward, we're hopeful that new student energy and new public input and interest will really start to revise this conversation and more specifically, the action that's necessary. Now, back to Patrick's comment, I do want to recognize the tremendous work that many faculty and staff have done and continue to do, from our Office of Sustainability to our operations and faculty colleagues, and to the past work of the Campus Sustainability Council. But I agree with Patrick. The truth is, we shouldn't be just celebrating those small successes, because what's happening here at MSU is we're delaying serious action. Our MSU emission reductions have essentially flatlined, as Patrick suggested, with Utah State University for that period of time before the commitments have been made. Our emissions have flatlined since 2012 at about 50,000 metric tons of CO2 equivalent. Now, some people may look at this as a victory because, you know, indeed our student population and our building square footage has increased. But the point is, as Patrick said, I think very well, the goalpost is zero emissions and getting there as quickly as possible. And specifically, we need to be reducing these emissions by at least 10% annually. And again, as I've said repeatedly, we need to do this in a very public way, so that our intentions, our actions, and our outreach efforts are showcasing the innovation and the creativity that should be coming from land-grant universities. That we treat this as a teachable moment for our students and for our communities, with this opportunity to demonstrate that we have the resolve to address the greatest threat to humanity. Now, Patrick, I'm curious if you want to offer anything about your climate action planning process.
I do. I'll just add one more point onto what you just said. You know, Utah State has also looked at this and said, well, we expanded in increased enrollments over that time when we were flatlined. And they did think of that as kind of a success. But that's the wrong metric. You know, the only thing that matters is the amount of carbon pollution that we're putting in the air. That's all the air cares about. It doesn't care about our enrollments. You know, it's the amount of carbon pollution we're putting in the air. That's what it's responding to. That's what's causing the damage. So our enrollments are really the wrong metric to be thinking about. But Utah State has tried to take credit for the same thing. In terms of our action planning, we've followed some of the same pathways that Montana State has. one of the fundamental things that we requested is that we need to make sure we have a robust process for estimating our emissions or carbon pollution. We had a very good process, I would say, but as we were going through this action plan, we identified a couple of other things that we need to be making sure we're accounting for. And so, you know, a robust accounting of our pollution is the basis for any kind of action planning and monitoring of successes moving forward. So that was our number one recommendation, is to make sure we close any of those loops that are open. A lot of the low-hanging fruit was in doing some of our energy efficiency things. And I'll give Montana State credit. They had done some of these things earlier than us, and we had been lagging behind. But some simple things like just converting all of our campuses over to LED lighting. LED lights use very little energy relative to even fluorescence, let alone the older incandescent lights. Facilities was planning to convert our campuses over to LED lighting over about 8 or 10 years. We got them to accelerate that to about a year and a half. And the reductions have been quite impressive, actually. We're not only saving money, but we're reducing the energy demand quite a bit just with that simple conversion. And you wouldn't notice any difference in the lighting on campus. It's actually better than it was before. A lot of other energy efficiency work that we're doing, the president and facilities have dedicated $500,000 per year to going through and doing building by building evaluations and improving energy efficiency within each building on a rotating basis. So that's also helping. But you know, we purchase a lot of our energy from external sources. And so that was another big puzzle that we're still working on. We purchased some of our power from Logan Light and Power, and then we purchased some of it from Rocky Mountain Power. And so our strategy there is to, well, number one, purchase renewable energy portfolios from Rocky Mountain Power. They have offered renewable energy portfolios, but I got to tell you, it's a tough road. We've been in negotiations with them for almost 2 years now, trying to purchase, you know, wind and solar and potentially geothermal. And we don't have a contract yet. And, you know, I keep in close touch with our energy manager, and he keeps telling me we're close to a deal. But there are a lot of complications that come up. We haven't gotten it done yet. And that's a failure up to this point, but I'm optimistic they're going to make good on that soon. Logan Light and Power did not have any kind of a renewable portfolio that we could purchase. And so our facilities director went to them proactively and said, hey, folks, we're hearing from our campus community that we really need much more renewable power. What can you do for us? And we went round and round with negotiations. Logan Light and Power decided it wasn't in their best interest to offer a renewable portfolio. It was a dead end up to this point. We've pushed back and said that's not good enough. And so we're continuing in negotiations with them, pushing them to develop a renewable energy portfolio that we can buy into.
While I'm listening to both of you talk about what some people would say are very controversial issues, I'm just wondering, what have been some of your most successful avenues for getting more people to recognize what you're saying is as critical as it is?
I think the summer that we have had has actually done a lot to bring it to the forefront of a lot of people's minds. Utah has been in an exceptional drought for most of the summer. We had a terrible snowpack last year. We had a lot of water restrictions. We were breathing wildfire smoke all summer. I'm guessing a lot of you up in Montana were experiencing a similar summer.
We had 30 houses burn down just outside of city limits. So that was a significant event here.
Yeah. So, you know, the wildfire is a complicated topic. I do a lot of research on that, but certainly climate change is increasing the amount and the severity of wildfires out there. So that has really helped bring it to people's minds. But there's been a lot of improvements in messaging around climate change. I mean, we've gone from a place where we were speaking essentially a different language that the public was not ready to hear. And I think a lot of climate change communicators are meeting people more where they're at now. And they're making those connections for people. They're helping people understand how their personal values, things that they value in their life, are going to be impacted by climate change. And that's changed a lot of the conversation. And I think, you know, just seeing it more and more in the media, on the radio, on TV, on the internet, even seeing people talk about climate change, talk about solutions, and talk about all these other benefits we get, you know, cleaner air, in addition to reducing all these other risks. I really do see a lot of the conversations changing and moving in the right direction there.
And I appreciate the question and in the fact that I'm hearing from students that this is that there's a kind of a change of consciousness, a kind of a paradigm shift with incoming students now. And you know, this kind of relates to the third strategy that we offered, which is about climate curricula and the need to create a more climate literate student body. You know, survey after survey is showing that young people are not just incorporating kind of this new climate consciousness into their daily lives, but they're pursuing environmental-related degrees and careers, and these numbers are surging. And in fact, a recent University of Southern California survey found that 64% of undergraduate students are very interested in on-campus sustainability, and the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics projects that employment opportunities for environmental scientists and related specialists is going to grow over the next 10 years at a rate much faster than growth in other industries, and that these pay ranges are going to be notably above overall median income levels. So I think students, you know, it's incumbent on us as faculty and administrators to listen to these students and to understand these trends. One other report from a Pew Research from just this year found that Gen Z individuals, those are young adults up to age 25, they're overwhelmingly worried about climate change. 76% of them say it's one of their biggest societal concerns, and 37% make it their number one concern. So I think land-grant universities can do a lot more to ensure that, you know, climate courses are part of our core curriculum, that they're required, and that they stress the intersectionality of all the complex issues that we're just starting to touch on, that include, you know, climate justice and racism and poverty, in addition to the hard sciences, the natural sciences that we're talking to. I'll also offer that I think there's widespread support from the public. And again, I'll reference the Yale program on climate change communications that I referenced earlier. Data show that here in Montana, between 65 and 81% of Montanans all across the state agree that schools should teach about the causes, consequences, and potential solutions to global warming. And there are many calls to mandate climate change education, you know, across K through 12 and beyond. And in fact, I just hosted a colleague from Columbia University who was on campus, and she spoke about their new Columbia University Climate School that is mandating climate change curriculum for everyone, regardless of your major. So it seems like the students want it, the citizens want it, and there's a lot of great models out there on, you know, on how we can and should be requiring land-grant universities to mandate climate curricula.
So speaking again of students, I understand there's a group of students at MSU that are working on a divestment of fossil fuel investments. Is that true?
That's right. In fact, this is the student group that I'm advising, the Campus Climate Coalition, is now working with the MSU Alumni Foundation. They've met with their board of governors, with members of the board of governors, and that board of governors controls the endowment. And I think to the tune of about $180 million is the MSU Alumni Foundation's endowment. And through this student's urging, and again, they've used very respectful, very professional tactics, the Alumni Foundation is now going to create a working group on divestment. And it's going to consist of six people, two individuals from the board, two that are going to be appointed by President Cruzado, our MSU president, and then two are going to be students from the Campus Climate Coalition. So I'm cautiously optimistic, and this is one of the fourth area that that we talked about, that land-grant universities could certainly get behind divestment and green capital campaigns. And I'm cautiously optimistic that, again, through student pressure, student interest, student involvement, involvement that will continue to move this conversation along. And
Are you aware of national trends for divesting on land-grant university campuses?
Sure, and there's a lot of great data out there that's being recorded. One source is Go Fossil Free, and they report globally the divestment movement has moved nearly $15 trillion, that's trillion with a T, of assets from over 1,300 institutions like universities and faith-based organizations and governments. They've moved those assets out of fossil fuel investments. And we're seeing that now across the United States, most recently Harvard University committing to divest its $42 billion endowment. The University of California announced that it will be divesting from all fossil fuels, its $126 billion investment portfolio. So the trend is very positive in that direction.
And I think the last two of your points address outreach, how to get this information more out to the state and to use different kinds of networks for impacting the national profile of climate change through universities. So the first one, I think, is the extension.
Yeah, a cooperative extension is the outreach arm of land-grant universities. But I want to note that land-grant universities, by default, focus on outreach work. That's part of our mission and mandate as faculty. But yes, cooperative extension can and should be playing a much more prominent role in climate education. And I'm associated with a new network. It's called the National Extension Climate Initiative. You can Google that. We call it NECI, National Extension Climate Initiative.net is the URL. It was established a couple of years ago by a group of faculty who, frankly, were concerned that more leadership was needed within and between states and across the nation, specifically on this topic of climate change. And the group formed to share resources and provide networking opportunities and better coordinate climate education activities. And that group completed the most comprehensive inventory of extension climate programs, and it included interviews with extension faculty and administrators across the system. And the report is available on the NECI website. And frankly, the results are alarming. What was found is that there are very few climate change programs in extension, most of which are just at the community or state-based level. Only a handful take place at the national level. There's concern with the lack of programs trying to reach youth and tribal populations, as well as those addressing these intersectional issues that I mentioned of race and health and equity and justice. And I think maybe most alarming, the report details accounts of censorship by supervisors, climate denial among work peers, and a fear of retribution for engaging in climate change programming by some of the individuals that were interviewed. So the group is now working with administrators and funders on a very coordinated national approach to climate change in extension. And we're also starting to see a lot of new positions in extension and land-grant universities specifically about climate change, climate science, climate communications. And I know that Patrick is involved in some new positions at Utah State University that are really exciting.
Yeah, we've got two new climate positions in our department. So a climate data scientist that we're bringing in to teach students about all the data skills they need to handle climate data. These are very complex data sets and to be able to utilize those to the fullest. And then a climate resiliency extension specialist. And this person is going to be working directly with state or federal agencies, maybe industry groups, maybe nonprofit organizations. They'll kind of develop their own constituency to help them understand the implications of climate change for whatever the natural resources they're trying to manage. So this is an important direction that our department's heading.
This seems like one highlight, having faculty with this expertise to join your department. Can you mention any other bright lights?
Yeah, there has been a tremendous advancement in technology over the last decade. It really is incredible how rapidly the technology is advancing in terms of renewables and a variety of other technologies that are helping us solve this problem. So that's actually been quite encouraging. I won't say the technology is going to solve it all for us. We need to be doing things differently, but it's certainly helping us solve this problem and maintaining a lot of our livelihoods. Another encouraging thing is just seeing so many people talking about it. When we normalize talking about climate change, it becomes part of our almost everyday conversation. We're not bottling up the anxiety associated with it. We're talking with each other about the solutions we want to see. We're talking with each other about the world we want to live in, a much cleaner, healthier world. And that, I think, is a very healthy thing. And then I'm really encouraged by the youth movements who are calling out the adults in their life for having failed on this up to this point. And I agree with them. We have failed them up to this point. Some of them are going on strike. Some of them are forcing change, but they're making things happen. It's really encouraging. I say that and I give them credit for that, but I also want to put it on the adults. This is not a problem that our youth created. And I think more of us adults need to be stepping up and taking this issue as seriously as it demands.
Maybe to build on Patrick's thoughts there, with new communication comes new ideas. And this is our sixth and final point about how land grants can be more responsible in the Anthropocene is through different types of experimentation and maybe even a paradigm shift. And we've been talking about land grant universities, but there are also sea grant. There's also space grant universities. In fact, MSU is part of the Space Grant Consortium. It's a national network that's working to strengthen aerospace research and education. So there's lots of models out there and ways to kind of evolve and innovate. But one that's particularly intriguing is a professor named Robert Kopp from Princeton University has published on this idea of creating what he's calling climate grant universities. And his idea is that the United States should establish this system of universities to again democratize access to education. But in this case, it's climate knowledge to aid the efforts to tackle the climate crisis. And so he's saying that, you know, now is the time to create this new generation of universities that, you know, prioritizing this climate grant idea that extends the land grant model for the 21st century. So again, this would be a nationwide system of universities with at least one in every state that would play a critical role in helping states and communities and businesses mitigate and adapt to global climate change.
So would that have to be a federal initiative, or is that something that the land-grant universities can create through, say, APLU? How would that come about?
Well, I guess formally it would come about through federal legislation as the Morrill Act and the 1994 Acts and others have done. But I think the APLU and land grants can get together and decide whatever type of innovation that they want to move forward. And I guess, you know, maybe I'll just conclude with this point that, you know, what we need now is these kind of bold ideas and bold leadership. We need leadership that will provide a vision of a future where, you know, the actions we take to address the climate crisis and climate disruption, that it takes center stage in a very public and inclusive way, and in a way that remains true to our ideal and our mandate of the land grant.
So my last question that I was going to ask, and you hit on it when you talked about leadership, is this a top-down or a bottom-up initiative?
All of the above. I think we really need to be moving from both ends on this. And from Utah State University, a lot of the movement has been from bottom up to this point. And I'd love to see more top-down initiatives. But I really think we need all hands on deck moving forward.
Well, I'll echo that. And again, this is, you know, as they say, it's a grassroots and a grass tops approach. And I think that, you know, with any democracy and any social movement we've seen in the past, whether it's the suffragette movement, the abolitionists, the civil rights movement, that impetus has come from the people. And really, I think that speaks again to our land grant mission, this idea of democratizing education. Really, the whole mission of this land grant ideal is that we bring this information to the people, and the people in turn mandate and ask for that action to be carried forward. So I'll echo Patrick's ideas that this really does require all hands on deck. This is described as an existential crisis. We are at a point in history within a generation or two of really determining the fate for the next several hundred years. If that responsibility doesn't weigh heavy on you, then you just need to wake up, and I think, and listen a little bit more closely and more acutely to the warning signs, the emergency that's out there, because we don't have a lot of time to wait.
I think one of the important things to recognize is that most of the barriers that we're facing are not technological. They're really psychological barriers to solving this problem. A lot of it is just our own egos. It's the momentum in our daily lives that we have not been making changes or doing the things we need to do, reduce our carbon pollution. And you know, we've been fixated on short-term issues. Universities are often very fixated on enrollments. We're fixated on broken pipes. We got to get those fixed right away. And we're not well wired to be addressing these really bigger picture, longer term threats. That's really a psychological change that needs to happen more than anything else. We've seen this in the COVID response. You know, if we could have imagined 2 years ago that we'd be shutting down the global economy, we would have said no way. If we would have thought about shutting down air travel, no way, that's impossible. But when we were faced with the emergency and we recognized it as an emergency, we respond to it appropriately. And I think the big psychological jump we have to make is to recognize this for the emergency that it is. And as soon as we do that, I have very high confidence that we can address it. We can avoid this becoming a train wreck. There is still time, but we really have to recognize it for the emergency that it is.
This has been a KGVM program on the responsibilities of land-grant universities in the Anthropocene. We've been talking with Dr. Paul LaChapelle of Montana State University and Dr. Patrick Belmont of Utah State University. Please check out Dr. Belmont's TED Talk, Redefining Climate Change Denial, and follow Dr. LaChapelle's work through the MSU Campus Climate Coalition and Climate Smart Montana. Thanks to Steve Durbin for technical support and to Joy LeClaire for editorial assistance. And as always, thanks to our KGVM listeners for joining us today. This program will be archived at kgvm.org. Feel free to share with friends, family, and colleagues. Then please consider donating to KGVM, the audio mirror of the Gallatin Valley and beyond. There's a donation button at kgvm.org. Remember, if we all give a little, we all get a lot. Thanks again, and take care out there.